theory about the fundamental structure of life. Someday we think it might be possible for us to delve down into the deepest recesses of our souls, lay our fingers on this mysterious universal essence, and avail ourselves of its tremendous powers. This, however, does not seem quite the right way to look at it. For one thing, it is not to be found only in the deepest recesses of our souls. And for another, the word essence makes it sound as if it were a highly refined, somewhat gaseous or electric and wholly formless potency that somehow dwells inside things. But in relation to Brahman, there is neither inside nor outside. Sometimes it is called the principle of non-duality, because nothing else exists beside it and nothing is excluded from it. It is to be found on the surface as much as in the depths, and in the finite as much as in the infinite. For it has wisely been said that there is nothing infinite apart from finite things. Thus it can neither be lost nor found, and you cannot avail yourself of its powers any more than you can dispense with them. For all these conceptions of having and not having, of gain and loss, finite and infinite, belong to the principle of duality. Every dualism is exclusive. It is this and not that, that and not this. But Brahman, as the one reality, is all-inclusive. For as the Upanishads say, it is made of consciousness and mind. It is made of life and vision. It is made of earth and waters. It is made of air and space. It is made of light and darkness. It is made of desire and peace. It is made of anger and love. It is made of virtue and vice. It is made of all that is near. It is made of all that is afar. It is made of all. What then is non-duality in terms of a state of mind? How does the mystic who has realized his identity with the one reality think and feel? Does his consciousness expand from out of his body and enter into all other things, so that he sees with others' eyes and thinks with others' brains? Only figuratively, for the self which is in him and in all others does not necessarily communicate to the physical brain of John Smith Mystic what is seen by the eyes of P. Wang, construction worker, on the other side of the earth. I do not believe that spiritual illumination is to be understood in quite this sensational way. We shall answer the question sufficiently if we can discover what is a non-dualistic state of mind. Does it mean a mind in so intense a state of concentration that it contains only one thought? Strictly speaking, the mind never contains more than one thought at a time. Such is the nature of thinking. But if spirituality means thinking only and always of one particular thing, then other things are excluded, and this is still duality. Does it mean, then, a mind which is thinking of everything all at once? Even if this were possible, it would exclude the convenient faculty of thinking of one thing at a time, and would still be dualistic. Clearly, these two interpretations are absurd. But there is another way of approach. Spiritual illumination is often described as absolute freedom of the soul, and we have seen that the one reality is all-inclusive. Is the mind of the mystic singularly free and all-inclusive? If so, it would seem that his spirituality does not depend on thinking any special kinds of thoughts, on having a particular feeling ever in the background of his soul. He is free to think of anything and nothing, to love and to fear, to be joyful or sad, to set his mind on philosophy or on the trivial concerns of the world. He is free to be both a sage and a fool, to feel both compassion and anger, to experience both bliss and agony. And in all this, he never breaks his identity with the one reality, God, whose service is perfect freedom. For he knows that in whatever direction he goes, and in whichever of these many opposites he is engaged, he is still in perfect harmony with the one that includes all directions and all opposites. In this sense, serving God is just living. It is not a question of the way in which you live, because all ways are included in God. To understand this is to wake up to your freedom to be alive. But is that all? Is it possible that spirituality can be anything so absurdly simple? It seems to mean that to attain spirituality, you have just to go on living as you have always lived. All life being God, any kind of life, is spiritual. You say that if the idea were not so ludicrous, it would be exceedingly dangerous. First, we might remind ourselves of a saying of the Chinese sage Lao Tzu. When the wise man hears of the Tao, he puts it into practice. When the fool hears of it, he laughs at it. Indeed, it would not be worthy to be called Tao if he did not laugh at it. The idea that any kind of life is spiritual is a terrible blow to man's pride. From the spiritual point of view, it puts us on the same level as stones, vegetables, worms, and beetles. It makes the righteous man no nearer to salvation than the criminal, and the sage no nearer than the lunatic. Thus, if all else about the idea is folly, it is at least a powerful antidote to spiritual pride and self-reward for being a good boy. Indeed, it is not something which you can get at all, however fierce your efforts, however great your learning, and however tireless your virtue. In the spiritual world, there is no top and bottom of the class. Here, all men and all things are equal, and whatever they do can go neither up nor down. The only difference between the sage or mystic and the ordinary unenlightened man is that the one realizes his identity with God or Brahman, whereas the other does not. But the lack of realization does not alter the fact. How then does one attain this realization? Is it just a matter of going on living as one has lived before, knowing that one is free to do just exactly as one likes? Beware of the false freedom of doing as you like. To be really free, you must also be free to do as you don't like. For if you are only free to do as you like, you are still tied up in dualism, being bound by your own whims. A better way of attaining realization is to let yourself be free to be ignorant. For fools are also one with God. If you strive to attain realization and try to make yourself God, you simply become an intense egotist. But if you allow yourself freedom to be yourself, you will discover that God is not what you have to become, but what you are, in spite of yourself. For have we not heard it said 1,000 times that God is always found in humble places? The Tao, said Lao Tzu, is like water. It seeks the lowly level which men abhor. And while we are busy trying to add cubits to our stature so that we may reach up to heaven, we forget that we are getting no nearer to it and no further away. For the kingdom of heaven is within you. Is there an unconscious? When we say that the chief contribution of modern psychology to human knowledge is the concept of the unconscious mind, we have to be careful of our terms. For the idea of the unconscious does not belong by any means to all modern psychology, and those schools to which it does belong have somewhat different views on the subject. The concept is associated principally with the names of Freud, Jung, and Adler. But there is no one name which covers their three schools. Freud's system is psychoanalysis. Jung's is analytical psychology. Adler's is individual psychology. There is no real reason, however, why they should not all be called psychoanalysis, because if, as is frequently done, we group them under the name modern psychology, we thereby group them with such important systems as Gestalt psychology, in which the concept of the unconscious plays no part. Popularly, it is believed that psychoanalysis teaches that man has an unconscious mind. This is not strictly true, for the unconscious is not to be understood as an entity or mental organism having definite location and identity. There is no actual division between the unconscious and the rest of the human organism, for it bears somewhat the same relation to the mind as the glands, liver, kidneys, etc., bear to the body. They are integral parts of the body, but we are not ordinarily conscious of them. The only difference is that the unconscious has no specific boundaries. It consists, rather, of the condition of being unaware of certain desires, impulses, tendencies, reactions, and fantasies in our mental and emotional makeup. It has its physical parallel in the condition of being unaware of various bodily organs and processes. There appears, however, to be little or no mention of the unconscious in the world's religious, mystical, and occult philosophy. Indeed, to many students of these matters, the idea is distasteful, and Freud, the father of psychoanalysis, has never been forgiven for regarding religion as a neurosis. In fact, the majority of religious people, whether of orthodox or heterodox persuasion, regard psychoanalysis in all its forms as an upstart science, whose avowed object is to debunk all the noble impulses of humanity by ascribing them to repressed sexuality. Much of the contempt in which psychoanalysis is held is well deserved. But this should not blind us to a certain amount of gold among the dross. The trouble with this new science is not so much psychoanalysis as psychoanalysts. We might mention the professor in charge of a certain well-known clinic who devotes his life to the study of inkblot tests. The patient is made to drop a blot of ink on a piece of paper and is suddenly asked what he thinks it looks like. Being rather puzzled and humorous, the patient usually grins and says something like, "Oh, it might be an elephant with warts." Whereat the professor assumes a faraway expression and murmurs, "Very significant. Most interesting. An elephant, yes. With warts. Exceedingly interesting." The case is not unusual, for the strange ways of psychoanalysts and psychiatrists would fill many volumes. I have heard fully qualified MDs discuss the case of a small boy whose propensity to bedwetting was undoubtedly due to his unconscious identification of himself with Jupiter Pluvius, Still more significant are the gatherings of doctors and patients for summer schools, where people take you by the hand, look into your eyes, and ask you whether you are an extrovert or an introvert. Indeed, such forms of psychology have swiftly acquired all the symptoms of crank religions. But just as there are half-wits and charlatans, as well as true students in mysticism and occultism, psychology also has its heights and depths, both as to its ideas and its practitioners. There are, too, the same internal conflicts, the same bigotry, the same dogmatism, and the same personal idolatry. But one could hardly expect otherwise, and the mutual contempt of religion and psychology is but the pot calling the kettle black. In spite of all, however, psychoanalysis has a definite and valuable contribution for students of religion in our time. I say in our time because psychoanalysis is essentially a modern remedy for a modern ill. It exists for that period of human history for which the unconscious is a problem. And a problem it has been since man began to imagine that all his difficulties of soul and circumstance could be solved by the unaided power of human reason. The ancient paths of mysticism and occultism resolved the problem of the unconscious from the very beginning, even before it became a problem. For their first requirement was that man should know himself, whereat he very quickly found that the huge brute forces of nature had their counterparts in his soul, that his being was not a simple unit, but a pantheon of gods and demons. In fact, all the deities of the ancient theologies were known to the initiated as the inhabitants not of Mount Olympus, but of the human soul. They were not mere products of man's imagination, any more than his heart, lungs, and stomach are products of his imagination. On the contrary, they were very real forces belonging both to nature, the macrocosm, and man, the microcosm. Occultism was thus the art of living with one's gods and demons, and you had to know how to deal with them in yourself before you could deal with them in the universe. The ancients understood the laws which man must follow in order to live with them. How, by love, the gods would become your friends and the demons your servants. In every initiation rite, it was necessary to pass through that valley of the shadows where the neophyte comes face to face with the dweller on the threshold and all the most terrible powers of the psyche. But the rite could only be successful if he faced them with love, recognizing them as manifestations of the same divinity which was his own true self. By this love, he broke their spell and became a true initiate. But man became over-rational and forgot the gods and demons, relegating them to the realm of outworn superstitions. He looked for them in the skies and found only infinite spaces, dead rocks, and orbs of burning gas. He looked for them in thunder and wind and found only unintelligent forces of the atmosphere. He looked for them in woods and caverns and found only scuttling animals, creaking branches, shadows, and draughts. He thought that the gods were dead, but in fact, they became much more alive and dangerous because they were able to work unrecognized. For whereas the old occultists began with the principle, know thyself, the rationalists began with, rule thyself. They chose what they considered to be a reasonable pattern of character and strove to impose it on their lives without any preliminary exploration. They forgot that it is impossible for man to behave like a sage until he has first come to terms with his inner pantheon,